Okay, welcome to the last question time. I should be so lucky. Because what happens, people say, just one question, just one last question. And there's always another one coming after the last question. But to let everybody know, oh my goodness, I better start quickly. The last talk which I will give this afternoon, I think it was at 1:30, will all be about like how to use some of these things you've learned in your daily life. So if there's any questions about, I'm going home this evening, what should I do? I'll actually talk about those this afternoon. But one last thing I will let you know. Today is a very special day. Not only is it the last day of this retreat, many of you may have noticed I shaved my head yesterday. And that is for a reason, because every day before the moon days, in my tradition, we have to shave. Today, if I'm not mistaken, is the full moon day. Full moon day today. Now, of course, as you all will know, that's the time of immense power. The Buddha became enlightened on the full moon day. So, having timed this retreat to perfection, all those energies are just coming to their peak on the time when the moon is full. So, if you don't see the nimitta, go outside tonight and you see the full moon. It's almost the same. And that will stimulate joy, happiness and peace in your mind. And who knows, just like the Buddha, this may be your full moon night. Okay. Dear Ajahn, can Feng Shui, the art of geomancy, change one's destiny? It can help. There's this story of this guy in England who was having trouble with his wife. A really bad relationship. Didn't know what to do. Tried all sorts of counselling. He went to his Feng Shui master and it solved the problem. No more marriage problems at all. The Feng Shui master told him to rearrange the furniture in his house. He did that. There's no problems afterwards. When his wife was out shopping, he put all his furniture against the door so she couldn't come in again. That solved all his problems. That's a joke. Yeah, it can help, but just only small amounts. What you do is more important. So that's just a help. I'm a Dharma pen pal to a Korean prisoner in San Francisco under the Liberation Prison Project. I don't know what offense he has committed to put him behind bars. He hasn't told me yet. He is already in prison for 20 years, my goodness, since the age of 17. Since your book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, is copyrighted, can I have your permission to photostat and send some of your stories to my pen pal? This will certainly help him look at things in a much broader perspective and hopefully make my correspondence with him more interesting. Thank you. Yeah, go and do that. So you can photostat some of that stuff if it's inside a jail, because it doesn't really matter. Because if you get prosecuted, you go to jail, you have all that photostatic stuff to look at. No, compassion is okay. I'll get you out of trouble. The thing is, you can't send too many copies. You can't photostat it and publish it, because then it's the publishers will get upset. But it's just a few copies here and there, especially if it's in prison. That shouldn't really matter. Does yoga practice help in meditation, directly, indirectly? As I heard from my yoga instructor say, there is energy arising during meditation. If one's body is not strong enough to withstand this energy, strong energy from deep meditation probably, this will injure the nerves. Once nerves are injured, very unlikely it will recover anymore. There are certain yoga postures which can strengthen the nerves. What is your comment? Depends what type of meditation you do. The meditation you do here will not injure your nerves, will strengthen your nerves, will not injure your body, but strengthen your body, will not injure your mind, but strengthen your mind. And in particular, it will take away all those fears. A lot of times it's too much fear. So you can do yoga. It helps, especially to loosen the body. It's a great thing to do, but it is not absolutely necessary. If you can't find the time, you don't like yoga, you don't have to do it, and you will not get injured. Any energy which comes up in the meditation, if you follow the instructions which I do here, it goes into the mind, not into the body. The energies go into the mind, makes you incredibly happy, powerful, blissful, and it releases the body. This is what I found again and again in meditation. If you leave the body alone, it looks after itself so well. So if I think I've told this story here in the first few days when I had typhus fever in the hospital. Remember that buffalo nurse who used to come and inject me? But it wasn't only that I think there was one time when I had this fever. You know, after I think about 2 or 3 weeks in the hospital, nothing was working. The fever was just as strong as ever. I was really, really weak. I remember just having to go to the toilet. There was no bedpans there, no one to help you go to the toilet. You have to do it yourself. So in this big, long ward, there's about a dozen beds in the ward. I was a long way from the toilet at the end of the ward. Decided to go to the toilet. I had to sort of get up out of bed and just prop myself up and really hold on to the bed rails because you were just so weak, you're almost falling over. And then you look at the bed just in front of you. Ready? Go. You just lurch for it to hold on, so stop yourself falling over. And then you have to wait for a couple of minutes to get energy to go to the next bed. And that's literally, I'm not exaggerating, that's sort of how weak you were because there's no one to help you. And you got to the toilet and you sat in there for at least an hour to get all your business done, absolutely, because you didn't want to make that journey again. You were so weak, so tired. You know, physically, you had no energy whatsoever, having a fever for 2 or 3 weeks. And at the end of that, I remember one day just feeling so awful, so tired, so sore, so almost depressed. But I had another way of dealing with depression. I said, right, let's go and do some proper meditation. That's why I got a beautiful meditation. And very deep. And all the pain, the body disappears in those deep meditations. You couldn't feel the tiredness of the body, the aches and the pains of a fever for such a long time. You know, when you have a fever, all your bones ache, everything aches. It's great. I had this wonderful bliss, peace, body completely disappeared. When I came out afterwards, I felt so good. I never really noticed at the time, but I know now that was probably the time the fever stopped and the thing sort of disappeared. It always happens that way. Noah Ajahn Chah said he had malaria for many, many years. He said one day he was just so fed up with having malaria, he just sat still. The fever got hotter and hotter and hotter until he said it was like being in the middle of a big blazing fire. But where he was sitting, in his mind, in the center, was absolutely cool. He said the fire got so hot, unbearably hot, that it just exploded. And that was the last time he had malaria. Meditation is great for getting rid of these things. So it doesn't create injury. It heals injuries in meditation. So the energy, because it goes into the mind, the body is basically healed. So you can do yoga, but it's not absolutely necessary. If you don't do yoga, you don't have to be worried. You will have wonderful energy, and your body will be able to withstand it without any problems at all. You'll be super empowered. You'll be, I'm super monk and that's super novice sitting next to me, then you'll be super layman and super laywoman. Just like Batman has his Robin. Super... Okay, sorry about that. Sorry to ask, but I don't really get what you mean by total listening. Listen to what I'm going to say now. Make your mind so still, so silent. Don't grasp onto anything I'm going to say next. Just allow it to soak in. Be absolutely 100% passive. That's what total listening is. As we're listening to Dharma talk, actually, we just listen clearly what has been said without adding on our own thinking perception. But then how do we interpret, relate or contemplate the content? Is it that we are supposed to do all this after the talk later or when the related situation occurred? We'll automatically recall what you've listened. Indeed. When you're very still, not only do you recall what is actually being said, but you also get the underlying meaning. Because like words... And this is the old, and I think I mentioned this before, you make these words and listen to what happens afterwards when you say peace, peace, peace. Every time, if you listen just after that sound finishes, the mind actually moves in the direction of peace. Every word is like a signpost. They're saying Chempaka Buddhist Lodge this way, toilets that way, dining room that way, peace that way. And when you follow that, when you listen to the word peace, the mind automatically will go in that direction. You don't have to send it. This is what words do. And so because of that, when you actually, I told you to maybe interrupt your meditation a few times, just saying calm, calm, calm. The reason you say those things is because after you said that word calm, the mind will actually go in that direction. It follows orders. It's like the taxi driver. So because of that, if I give a lecture or someone else gives a great Dhamma talk, you should just allow the mind to follow the orders. Your mind is like a taxi driver. Your mind will just follow and actually will go to where those words are pointing you to. You start talking about non-self. And if you don't think about it, just allow those words just to sink in. Now, you're being conditioned by the monk. You actually go towards non-self. Which is why in the time of the Buddha, because people had faith and they knew how to totally listen, sometimes when the Buddha gave a Dhamma discourse, many people became enlightened. That surprised me at first when I read those sutras. I heard sutras like the great 60, where it was saying that after that, all these hundreds of monks became enlightened. Four arahats just after reading this sutra. So one day I decided to read that sutra out to my monks. Not one of them became enlightened. Why? It's exactly the same teaching. It's because in the time of the Buddha they really knew how to totally listen. Their minds were so silent because of samadhi practice that what was said, the mind followed those words, looked to the signpost and followed it to where it was pointing to. And there they saw the Dhamma. That's why they became enlightened. So if you totally listen, sometimes you don't remember the words, yes, but you remember where it's pointing to. When you go to the restaurant, you don't try and remember the menu. You use the menu for its purpose, which is pointing you to the food. All these words, his talks, are just like that menu. They point you to the food of liberation. So, totally listen. You don't need to remember anything. You just need to follow the signpost. See where it's pointing. Unfortunately, these days, many people collect menus. They collect Theravada menus, Mahayana menus, Zen menus, Christian menus. And they argue who's got the best menu. They translate the menu into many, many different languages and print the menus out for free distribution. And you see many people taking these free distribution books, all these different menus, and nobody orders the food. You understand? How many books have you got? How many menus have you got in the house? Are you peaceful yet? Are you happy? Are you liberated? Can you get nimittas, jhanas, insight? No, because we're still on the menu. We haven't ordered the food yet. So be careful. Total listening. Shh. That was a great thing that, you know, you learned that as a young monk. You listened to Ajahn Chah. Not only did you remember the words, there was a time when you were following those words, you got the meaning. What Ajahn Chah was pointing to, and you couldn't listen to any more of the talk. You just blissed out with the meaning for the rest of the talk. And this is what happens sometimes. If you're hearing a talk, and then I say something, which really hits the nail on the head, you'll go and follow that to its meaning, where it's pointing to. And you'll forget everything else, because you will not be listening to my talk. You'll be going into your mind. And I am very happy if that occurs. It means my talk has done its job. So you don't give talk just to give more information. You've got information overload already. Look at all these questions which come from information overload. What one really needs to do is to get these words, follow the meaning, so there's no more questions anymore. How many guidebooks do you need to Kuala Lumpur? You just need one, and then go and see for yourself. So that's what total listening is. Next question. If my spouse commits adultery, having a relationship with another woman, does it justify divorce? You have mentioned that it is harmful to our relationship. It really depends what type of relationship you have. If you have a Dhamma relationship, loving kindness, the door of my heart is open to you, husband, no matter what you ever do. Can you do that? It's wonderful, because if he's having a great time with somebody else, you can come to the temple every day, you can go on retreats, you can keep your 8 precepts at home, because he's having sex with somebody else. You're free. What's wrong with that? You can be celibate now. Isn't it the case that if that's happening, it's just because of your pride? You think, nah, no, he prefers someone else than me. Nah, of course it's his bad karma, yeah, but you don't have to make it your bad karma. You can use anything in this life to liberate yourself. And if that happens, he's happy with somebody else, then you're well rid of him. So off you go, go on, go, 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 go. He said, I'm so happy just being here. So you can go to the temple every day, you don't have to worry, and you can tell him, if that's your mistress, she can cook for you as well. I'm not going to cook for you. She can do your laundry, I'm not going to do your laundry. So, she's your wife now. Good, off you go. Go, 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 go. And you can have such a peaceful, happy time going to the temple, meditating. You know how hard it is? You know, all you women over here, you have to worry about your husband, what he's doing, always got to be kind to him. Oh, it's such a burden. It's the same with your wife as well. You know, she's gone off with someone else. Oh, isn't that wonderful? You're free like a bird. You can go wherever you want. Have I convinced you? No, I haven't. So does it justify divorce? Yeah, if you really want to. But if it's you've got kids there, then maybe you can actually have a good talk. In other words, just talk with the guy, confront him, get him in the right mood, and talk. Say, look, it's not just you. It's us. It's our family. So, you know, what can we do? This is a problem. Can it be solved? It's not your problem. It's not my problem. It's our problem. It's a family's problem. So always when you have a problem like this, never say it's your problem or it's my problem. When we share our problems, it's our problem. Then what that means is everybody contributes to a solution. If you confront someone that says your problem, people sort of realize that they're going to do it all. You're not contributing at all. They get upset. What do you mean? And they never do anything. Always say our problem. And never put the problem on the person, you stupid husband. It's not the husband, the person is the problem, it's the adultery is the problem. So depersonalize it. Don't say you're an adulterous husband, you're a husband who's committed adultery. Remember this supermarket checkout simile? It's not a stupid child, you're a person who's done a stupid thing. And if it's a husband who's committed adultery rather than an adulterous husband, there's a way out then. He realizes it's more than that one act, and you realize it's more than that act. And therefore, there's a possibility of forgiveness and moving away from that bad action. So you have to be very skillful in such a situation. And if when you talk about it, there is a possibility that, you know, he will actually behave himself and he really wants to commit to the marriage and the family. If he really wants to commit, then give him forgiveness. You actually tell him in Buddhism we do this 3 times. 3 strikes and you're out. We mean out. No, 2 times, we're going to forgive you twice, 3 times, that's it, divorce, get out of here. And be firm, like with children, you have to set the boundaries, you have to keep to those boundaries. You can't just say, okay, one more time. So when he knows where he stands, you know where you stand. It's quite clear, you can give forgiveness twice, 3rd time, out. Okay? Can we meditate at any place, e.g. in a hotel room? Yes, you can. I mentioned to you that I'm going to Jakarta in a couple of weeks. I heard from the organizers, because they're holding this seminar in the Hilton, they want to put me up in the Hilton, but as I think many of you know, I read the newspapers just before I came, the Australian government was saying, please don't go to Jakarta if you're an Australian. There's a terrorist threat, and the place they're threatening is the Hilton Hotel. So it doesn't matter, I'm protected. So I'll just do lots of loving kindness there, and the bombs won't go off, if there's any bombs. It's amazing what you can do. But anyway, so you can meditate in any place, in a hotel room, that is fine. And it's great to meditate in a hotel room because you can spread good energy out there. Because sometimes hotels are not the best of places, all sorts of stuff goes on in there. And also people are very tired, sometimes they get drunk in the hotels. It's a great place to spread some good karma, some good energy. So out of compassion for all beings, you can meditate and spread loving kindness in hotel rooms. I was told not to, as it may attract spirits. Is it true? Only if you ring the room service will you attract the spirit cup. The ghost bottles. So don't ring up for the bottle ghosts. It will only attract good spirits. Remember, if you're a meditator, you're more powerful than the bad spirits. The good spirits, they will come to you and protect you. So only get good spirits if you meditate, not bad ones. If each individual is different, rebirth, how to apply the similar characters to characters of identical twins. Okay, identical twins are never identical. Look, I see one in front of me who's brown, the other one is white. Are you identical twins? Not really. You look pretty similar. But I know that sometimes it's weird how people are pretty close together, but they always have some differences. If you don't believe me, ask their mothers. The mothers always know which one is which shows they aren't the same. They have slightly different characters and sometimes hugely different characters. For example, I know one pair of identical twins. One is one of my disciples, he's a Buddhist. The other one is a Catholic. They're identical twins, completely different religions, let alone sort of looking the same. So they are different because different streams of consciousness come into the womb. There's similarities because if you're going to share a womb together and you're going to be identical twins, you must have done some karma in the past together. There must be some connection there, and that's a connection from previous lives, gives them similar experiences, similar outlooks. Because usually if you had a choice, if you're a Buddhist, would you share a womb with a Catholic? The chances are you'd be attracted together, birds of the same feather fly together. So you'd probably actually go into the same womb together. So usually most twins would be a Catholic with a Catholic, a Buddhist with a Buddhist. No twin share in the womb. And that's what happens, you see. That explains why many twins have got similar characteristics, but they aren't the same characteristics. Okay, next question. If parents divorce because of extramarital affairs, must be lots of extramarital affairs going on around here. There are many instances that children experience similar situation, i.e. they or their spouses have extramarital affairs and divorce. Is it because of bad karma of parents? Yes, it is. Because, we set the example to others. We teach by example much more than words. So if the parents, say to their children, you've got to keep your precepts, when you go to university, don't drink, don't take drugs. But the parents are hypocrites, and then the children won't follow. Remember when I was a school teacher, there was a rule in the school I was teaching at, no smoking. And the children would complain to me. They said, look, there's a rule for no smoking, but every time we knock on the staff room door and the door opens, there's billows of smoke come out where the teachers were. Because the teachers were ordered to smoking. They said, you're just a bunch of hypocrites. And I said, yeah, they are. I didn't smoke, but the other ones did. And so, if you're going to tell other people not to do something, you should not do it yourself. There's that wonderful story of Gandhi. It was in his autobiography. When he was a young student in London studying law, like many students in those days, he was staying in a boarding house with a landlady, just a room, she'd make all the meals for him. One day she came up to him and said, Mr. Gandhi, he was only a student at this time, I want your help. My son is eating too much sugar. It's bad for his health. I've told him many times he won't listen to me. But I don't know why, for some reason, he respects you. Can you please tell my son not to take too much sugar? And Mr. Gandhi said, yes, I will tell your son, madam. The days went past, they turned into weeks, and the son was still taking as much sugar as before. So the landlady went up to Mr. Gandhi and said, "Mr. Gandhi, do you remember that conversation we had where I asked you to intervene and talk with my son to stop him taking sugar?" He said, "I remember that, madam." "Well, you promised me you'd talk to my son, but you haven't. Why?" And she said, "I have, madam. I only talked to him this morning." "Why did you wait so long?" said the landlady. "I had to wait till this morning to talk to your son, madam, because it was only yesterday that I gave up sugar." And that's actually why he became a great man. No hypocrisy at all. If you're going to tell other people to keep the five precepts, you have to keep those precepts yourself first. If you're going to teach your children to be good, caring, committed to the relationship, their children, your parents, they've got to do their job. You have to do your job as well. And if you teach your children by example, it's all right to cheat on your wife, then of course they're going to learn that. And that's not going to make them be adulterous, but it's going to incline them to adultery. That's why, if you're going to be a parent, you really have to look at yourself and say, "Am I worthy of being a parent?" Make sure you have your precepts. You have your wisdom. Being a parent, being a husband, being a wife is full of sacrifice. It's not just for your own pleasure. It's for service to your family, for letting go. That's why it is a spiritual path if you use it properly. Any questions on that? Okay, next question. If we cannot see our past lives by way of meditation, can we do it through New Age methods such as past life regression? Is it good to know our past lives? I reckon it is good to know your past lives, and some past life regressions can work, but sometimes you have to be very careful because sometimes you get false memories. They're not really true. That's why past life regression through hypnotherapy can work, but sometimes it's not as accurate and not as good as the ones you get in deep meditation. Obviously, deep meditation is much harder to get your past lives. But when you get them, they're far more accurate, far more reliable. However, you can use past life regressions. In Australia some years ago, this wonderful TV series, or not TV series, a documentary called Reincarnation Experiments, where he was a psychologist in Sydney. He was regressing some of his patients through hypnosis, especially if they had some sort of phobias or some mental disorder, little things, even like depression or anxiety. And he had this brilliant idea because he had some people who remembered their past lives clearly. There were past lives in a place where they could prove they'd never been to before. And they were past lives in recent history, maybe 100, 200 years ago, where, if it was true, it should not be that difficult to find records of such people. For example, that one of the cases, and what he did, he contacted the local TV studio, a great idea for a documentary, Reincarnation. You can come and film these, all ladies as it turned out, under hypnosis, film their memories, and then you can pay the fare to take them over to Europe and places and see if what they remembered was right. It was a very interesting TV series. But one of them, for example, she was a woman who was born in Sydney, lived in New South Wales all her life. It was very easy to check with the passport office that she'd never been out of the country. And she remembered her previous life as a doctor in Scotland in the 19th century. Now, doctors were very important people in the 1860s, I think it was, that there should be some record of that person in that place. And especially that she said that in her previous life she was a man by the name of Dr. James Archibald Burns in a town of Blagarie in Scotland. And I was brought up in England and I travelled in Scotland extensively. I'd never heard of a town called Blagarie. It's one of the small towns amongst many others. What are the odds, the chances, Now, even James is a common name, but Archibald isn't. Burns, obviously, is a very common Scottish name. But what's the chances of getting a Dr. James Archibald Burns as the MD, the general practitioner in that town? The town will only have one doctor. What are the chances? And of course, they went there with their cameras, searched around in the local public libraries, and there, document after document, about Dr. James Archibald Burns, MD. They took this lady back to Aberdeen, where she did her medical degree at Aberdeen University in the 1840s and 50s. As soon as she saw the place, she took the TV camera all over the place. She'd never been there before in this life. She knew all the nooks and crannies. It was amazing just how accurate it was. And that was the case, that she obviously had remembered her past life, and it was true, no doubt about it. And that was through regression. Sometimes it is right, but sometimes it doesn't work. Fascinating. So you can do that, and sometimes it is interesting. At the very least, it proves to yourself that there is such a thing as past life. I'd like to, any evangelical people, I'd like to regress them, so they do find out that they have lived before. And they're probably a Buddhist before. Now they will not sort of be so upset at other religions. I would like to regress Mr. Bush to see that he was maybe an Iraqi in his last life. Mr. Sharon, so he could know he was a Palestinian. Then we wouldn't think that we are so special and our group, our religion, our race is somehow important, more important than others. Dear Ajahn, this might not be an appropriate question, but the curious cat strikes. Does a lady have bad karma if a monk disrobes and marries her? I would like to express my sincere gratitude and rejoice at the wonderful Dharma expanded by Ajahn during the short retreat. Does a lady have bad karma if a monk disrobes and marries her? It really depends exactly what you do and how you do it, because if it's just some karma from the past, and the monk is just a young monk, and you have no real intention to, you know, disrobe anybody, and it just happens. Obviously, there's no bad intention there. You're just a human being, and the young monk is just a human being. So it's not really, really bad karma. But if you go in there thinking this is just a challenge, which, you know, some women can do. There was one of my friends who's a monk in the Burmese tradition. He was maybe about 13 or 14 years as a monk. It's a warning we tell other monks. He was in the Buddhist Society of Victoria. I'm the spiritual advisor of that place, so I know exactly what goes on there. He was staying there giving some teachings because his mother lived in Melbourne, so he was staying there giving some teachings. And then there was an Indonesian girl, quite attractive, whose parents were incredibly rich, billionaires. So she had more than enough money for the rest of her life. She was just a playgirl, that's all. And so she decided, just as a challenge, something to do, you know, rich girl's plaything, she decided to see if she can disrobe that monk. And so she started talking with him, chatting him up, wearing nice clothes, being kind, and he fell for it. And one day he decided, right, he was in love with her. She was in love with him. So they left the temple in Melbourne. They got into a taxi. He went to a hotel. He rang up from the hotel to, I think, the president, saying, look, I'm disrobing, I'm no longer a monk. He did it the proper way. Went into the hotel room. They had one night together. He thought, right, that's it. I'm going to fall in love. I'm going to marry this girl. After that one night, she just dumped him. Goodbye. Have a nice life. And he was just so heartbroken and disappointed. I thought you loved me. I just wrote to get married to you. It wasn't that at all. It was just the fun of actually seeing a monk sitting high up on the seat, everyone listening to his talks, so she could disrobe him. Just something to do for a rich girl. And completely left. So that monk, he was very good. Afterwards, he said, he came back the next week into the Buddhist center, said, I was so stupid. And he sort of, he was honest about his lust. He said, I lost it. And that woman sort of tricked me. But such a woman as that, yes, they did do enormous bad karma. That was really mean, and that was very cruel, and not the right thing to do. But the monk was stupid as well. He should have seen it coming. That's bad karma. But if it's, you know, there's sometimes karma from the past. We always tell the story in the Northeast Thai tradition. There was this one monk. He started getting incredibly deep meditation, started getting his psychic powers. And then everyone thought this would be a great teacher for the future. But one day an alms round, he saw a girl offering food. She was about from a nearby village. She was just visiting her relations. And just he got so much lust coming up for this girl. And she for him. And now, being a good monk, he went back and told the teacher. And the teacher said, well, look, it's best if we send you to another monastery so you don't see her again. Because he wanted to be a monk. He didn't want to get married. He had powers and stuff. So they took them to another monastery. And just he was happy for a while until, just as it happened, there's no sort of intention here, the woman was visiting another relation in that monastery as well. And again, the lust came up. And then the abbots of this monastery, they looked into their mind and found out, yeah, this guy had been married to her for many, many lifetimes. And the abbot realized it was impossible to stop. So eventually the monk just arrived and got married to her. It was not his fault, it was not the wife's fault, it's just karma is sometimes that strong. So in that case, there's no sort of, no bad feeling. There's no bad karma. It's just, you know, just intentions and power from the past. That's all you can do. So that's what happens sometimes. So it's not really bad karma for the woman, not bad karma for the monk. It's just what happens sometimes in those situations. But sometimes if you're just playing around just to see what you can do, then no, don't do that. That's bad karma. Any questions on that? Okay, next question. 10 days is not enough. Now be easily satisfied, be contented, yeah. Happy indeed to follow in the footsteps of the Buddha. Twice I'm at the door of jhanas, but my heart couldn't take it. I tried mind programming, but now not working. I believe that I shall still need to polish up my paramis. Correct me if I'm wrong, Bhante. You don't know how close it may be. Sometimes you say, it's the last day, give up. No chance now. And right at the very end, when you think now's the time to go, the last sitting, the last minute, then it comes. Isn't that happen sometimes? Sometimes you try so hard. You try. And just when the breakfast is about to begin, then it starts to get peaceful. You ever notice that happen? Your mind all over the place, and just before lunch, it starts to come. The point is, don't have lunch. Don't have breakfast. Carry on. So, who knows? There's still many moments to go. Some people say, oh, there's only a few hours to go. But listen, what we finish at 3 o'clock, it's another 6.5 hours. That's 6.5 hours, that's almost 400 minutes. That's 24,000 seconds. And it only takes 1 second to get into jhana. You've got 24,000 opportunities. Isn't that amazing? Just what you can do. 24,000 opportunities to get into jhana. Who knows? One of those 24,000 might be yours. So yeah, sometimes it just happens. Dear Ajahn, when we let go of everything, i.e. don't want anything, don't do anything and just watch doing meditation, that is being unconditioned, isn't it? Of course, as Ajahn puts it, once past first jhana, even from second jhana upwards, when one is stripped of will, one is the unconditioned already. There you are unconditioning yourself, but there's many layers of conditioning. You strip away one layer and you find another one, and there's another one underneath that. That's why the Buddha called these sankharas. He described them like a plantain tree, because it's layers of leaves, you strip them away, but there's no pith, there's no solid wood in the plantain tree. That's why you take away all these conditioned realities. Take them away, and then eventually you find there's nothing inside. The whole tree stands on conditioned phenomena, nothing solid there at all. Or, as Venerable Bhante Gunaratna said, instead of calling it a plantain tree, it's like an onion. An onion is the same. You can peel it. It's just leaf after leaf. When you get to the center, there's nothing. You can peel it. It's just leaf after leaf. When you get to the center, there's nothing left. But the wonderful thing about an onion is it's the letters of its English name. An onion, it goes on and on with an I in the middle. Onion, on and on with an I in the middle. So, with the conditioned and the unconditioned, you let go of the conditioned more and more and more and more and more. Let go of all the forms, the created things, till you go to the uncreated. Go into the middle of things. So every time you see the lotus petal, it is conditioned phenomena. Even the Buddha said the jhanas, they're not the unconditioned, but they're getting very close. All the petals are conditioned phenomena. When you peel them all off, in the center, emptiness. Okay, when chanting the homage to the Triple Gem with closed eyes, I get into a sensation of into a space. Please advise if this is wrong. This is especially so when I focus at the nose while chanting. Amazing, the first Malaysian man or woman in space. You don't need to go to NASA. You know how this space tourism these days? If you're a millionaire or a billionaire, they can shoot you up into space. You don't need to go to NASA and spend billions of dollars being a space tourist. You can save all the money. In fact, instead of giving the 3 or 4 million, however it costs, to NASA or to the Russians, you can give it to Champaka Buddhist Lodge. And I will send you into space. You can be the inner space tourist in Champaka Buddhist Lodge. For a very cheap price. All you need to do is to chant the Triple Gem, and with inspiration, close your eyes, you get the sensation of space. Very good. This is not wrong, you're enjoying it. Great, well done. Next question. When I sit and bring my attention in front of me or within, I can feel and perceive the body erect and some chi sensation surrounding the body. The pain reduces. I tend to use this as a preparation before observing the Buddha. Is this correct? Yes, it's good. So, paying attention in front of me or within, you can perceive the body erect, some energy in the body, because when you let go, the energy starts to flow, the pain reduces, and it's a great way of preparing the body. That sounds good to me. Next question coming up soon. Dear Ajahn, in stage 4, full sustained attention in the breath, quoted from your book, The Basic Method of Meditation, what do you mean when the first sensation of in-breathing arises? Could you kindly elaborate and give examples? Could you also kindly describe your way on stage 4 in details? When you let the breath disappear, do you purposely stop breathing at all? Lastly, when the breathing disappears, the mind is now taking the mind as its own object. Is this object the disembodied beauty? Yeah, it's quite simple. When you get more mindfulness of the breath, it's not just going in and going out. The breath starts to get more details. A simile I gave in the very beginning of this retreat is very helpful. If you go from the light outside into the dark, late at night, you can't see anything at first. All you can see is shapes. Maybe you might know it's a pillar or a man, but you don't know which man it is. After a while, your eyes accustom itself to the darkness. You start to see more of what's out there. More details become apparent. So you can see which man it is, whether young or old, whether it's a monk or a layperson. The details soon fill out. In the same way, when you start watching the breath, all you can see in and out, that's all maybe. As the mindfulness gets brighter, you see more of the breath, you see more detail. It's not just in and out, it's beginning the in-breath, right to the very end. You see more. It is natural. It just happens all by itself. In the same way, when you were walking meditation, in-out, left-right, left-right, after a while, you start to see all the feelings of one foot moving. From the left foot moving, from where it started to where it's finished, there's a flow of different sensations. You become more alert, more mindful, like when you're in the dark, you start to see more. It's a natural progression of growing power of your mindfulness. As you start to see more of the breath moving, in breath, out breath, you can actually notice just the very initial stages. Just when the in breath starts. Just like the first stage when your foot lifts up. You can notice that. As the mindfulness gets stronger. What happens next is because the mindfulness gets stronger and more still, that breath going in and going out is just so beautiful after a while. It's accompanied by this feeling of joy. It's a beautiful breath. It happens quite naturally. You just, your mindfulness getting strong. Whatever you see looks more beautiful. As I mentioned, with superpower mindfulness, even the flowers in front of me, they glow in their colours. They're not just ordinary yellows and whites. Incredibly powerful and deep colours. You're not adding that. The colour's not in the flower. You're actually seeing it more fully because of your mindfulness. Sometimes it's like you're driving along the road and you realise your windscreen hasn't been washed for days. You can see things, but they're all dull. So you clean your windscreen of your car and everything is just so sparkling in the sunshine outside. The windscreen of your car being dirty stands for the five hindrances. You've got five hindrances, you can only see dull shapes. When those five hindrances are taken away, what you see is sparkling and clear and energized. So this is what we do. We see more of the breath and it becomes more beautiful, more sparkling. It happens quite naturally that the breath disappears. It's not the breath doesn't stop. You're still breathing, but you're taking your attention away from it. You don't notice it anymore. Just like your heart is beating, but you don't notice it. Because it's not important anymore. Like the simile of the bird on the tree with the arches. The bird is still there, but you can only see the eye. The rest has disappeared. So you start with the full attention on the breath, and then it becomes a beautiful breath. You don't do it purposely, it happens naturally. Just like the lotus opening up, one leaf after another, you don't purposely get hold of those petals and pull them apart. You just keep warming the petals, as it were, with your mindfulness, still mindfulness, and it opens up by itself. A natural evolution of mindfulness. So when the breathing disappears, the mind does take the disembodied beauty, the brightness of the mind. Many people, many meditators recognize that as the mind becoming bright. Sometimes you see a black screen or a white screen, but it's very beautiful and peaceful. And from that white screen or that black screen, if you can only leave it alone, just like another layer of petals on the lotus, leave it alone. Just be mindful of that. Don't move the mindfulness. If you say, what should I do next? You're actually like the sun moving on to another lotus and taking its heat away from the lotus you're on now. So that's why it goes wrong. Just stay put. Don't do anything. Be patient. And mindfulness will warm that black screen or that white screen, and then a limiter will come out from the center. That's the way it works. Is that clear? Yeah? Okay, you're saying if the breath gets very refined, it disappears, should you find some object to focus on? No, you have the object to focus on. When petals open up from a lotus, they reveal the petal which is inside. So when the breath disappears, what's left when the breath disappears, that's what you focus on. The point is that when the breath disappears, you're not used to that sensation, you can't recognize it, you're not familiar with it. So you can't grasp it that easily. We're used to only focusing on things which are solid, which we can grasp. And when I say, just what's left after the breath disappears, just focus on that. What am I supposed to do? It's the same that sometimes with new meditators, I say, let go of the past, let go of the future, focus on the present. They say, what the heck is that? What am I supposed to do in present moment awareness? What am I supposed to watch? The present. Yeah, but what is it? It's what happens when the past and future disappears. Yeah, but give me something solid. The point is, because we're not familiar with these refined things to actually to focus on, it takes a while before, I say, what's left when the future and the past disappear? And they keep asking that question until they become familiar with that experience called now. Once you become familiar with it, you know exactly what it is. Then the mind knows what to focus on. And it becomes so wonderful. even like silence. No thoughts. Some people, they never had, they never noticed a moment when they weren't thinking about something. And so you do the space between the breaths. So the space between the thoughts, meditation. Because when one thought finished, another thought hasn't begun, you notice that. They become familiar by what we mean by silence. And then after a while, when you know what we're talking about by silence, you can recognize it, you can actually allow it to grow. You can stay with it because you recognize it. A friend who you know all about. It's the same with what happens when the breath disappears. Allow that to be. Soon you become familiar with it. You know who it is. And then you can stay there as long as you like. But don't go anywhere else. The petal is opened. What you're looking at now may not be clear to you yet. Stay with it. It's just like another layer of darkness. You have to allow the eyes to accommodate to that darkness, and you'll see that what you thought was nothing there was actually a lot of beautiful things. Like when you go outside from a light room into a dark room, it takes a while to see what's there. First you think there's nothing. There is. Your mindfulness just has to grow that little bit stronger to see what's there when the breath disappears. So don't do anything, just wait. Dear Ajahn, I have heard of spirits who repeat their deaths, e.g. suicides, and are forever caught in an endless cycle, like the ghost who keeps on ringing the doorbell wanting to get in the house. Is there any way to help these spirits? Does transferring merits help? Was it the spirit's karma to repeat that endless cycle with Megametta? Okay, what happens? Everyone's going to put Megametta on there now, so I better change it to, after Megametta, Gigametta. That's actually the next stage up, from megabytes to gigabytes. So I'm going to start writing on my book now with Gigametta. Gigametta, sorry. And that we're going to change afterwards to Gigametta. For the Hahayana path. So if anyone asks you, is Ajahn Brahm a Hinayana monk, a Theravada monk, a Mahayana monk? You can say, Ajahn Brahm, he follows the Hahayana. Anyway, yes. So, you can actually change your habits. You change your habits through mindfulness. So somehow you've got to inspire that ghost actually to have some bit of mindfulness so you can see exactly what it's doing. It doesn't repeat the same old habits. Which is why I've taught you, I'm not sure if you've done this yet, when you get up in the morning, you brush your teeth. Are you still brushing the teeth in the same corner of the mouth as you usually do? Don't be creatures of habit. You'll die. Don't always sit in the same place. Don't always do the same thing. Otherwise, you're just a robot. So, if you're a robot, you'll keep repeating the old bad habits. Just like those ghosts or those suicides. With mindfulness, you see exactly what you're doing. One of the other definitions of mindfulness, you've got many, many doors to come in, to go out from. If you're a creature of habit, you only see the well-worn path. You've always gone in that door, you always go out that door, you always eat the same breakfast, you always do the same things, you're a routine person. And sometimes you die. If you're a routine person, if you've committed suicide in your past life, when things get tough, you do the same thing again. A person of routine, you see your husband, you always say the same rotten things to him. Your wife, you always treat them the same way. You can't change the bad habits of life because it's automatic. You don't do it without thinking. However, when you have mindfulness, you have so many different opportunities. You can do things in a different way. You don't have to always repeat your past mistakes. So, develop a strong mindfulness and you'll find you'll be able to stop. Even if you're a ghost, you will not ring the doorbell more than once. You ring the doorbell, the mindfulness will come. What in the heck am I doing that for? You don't have to ring the doorbell. You realize as a ghost, you can just walk straight through the door. Much more fun. It's just because of his old habit. The old habit was as a person who owned that house, he always had to have someone open the door to go through. That's why he can't open the door himself. So he's trying to get someone else to open the door for him. Just a creature of habit. He's a ghost now. He doesn't need the door to be opened. He can just go right through. Perhaps we shouldn't tell him that because the owners of the house will probably be very upset at me if I tell that ghost, just go straight through, enjoy yourself. And the same with suicide. You don't have to solve the problem that way. In fact, you're not solving the problem. There's many other better ways to solve the problem. So, you have alternatives. Mindfulness gives you alternatives. Any question about that? If there is no self, why is there karma? There was once a monk, when the Buddha was teaching anatta, said exactly the same. And the Buddha blasted him. He said, you think you can outstrip the teachings of the Buddha, you stupid monk. Now, be careful, because there is karma on the stream of consciousness. The stream of consciousness has suffering, unhappiness, happiness as well in its process. Karma works on the stream of consciousness. It's cause and effect, that's all. So it's important that you make good karma in order for your stream of consciousness to be happy. Don't we say, may all sentient beings be happy and well? Your stream of consciousness is a sentient being. It's not a permanent self, but it is a being like life. Just as you wish loving kindness and happiness to all beings, you should wish it to your own stream of consciousness as well. Even though other people's consciousness aren't yours, you still wish them well. So you should always wish well to your stream of consciousness. Always make merit, even if you're an arahat. Just out of compassion. If abortion is needed due to medical reasons, or is it true that bad karma generated could be reduced if forgiveness is sought before the abortion? Again, it's the intention there is important. In that case, some years ago in England, I was visiting my mother in England, about 4 years ago, I saw this in a newspaper that there was a woman in a hospital, I think she was in Wales somewhere, and she had twins inside her womb because of some medical condition. If she just went ahead with a natural birth, the two twins would certainly die and so would she. And the doctor was saying, well, if we abort one of those children, the other one would live and so would the mother. And so they had this ethical debate. Most of the evangelicals were going, no, leave it to God. And the doctor was saying, look, if we leave it to God, the whole three of them will die. So if it's God's will, okay, they'll die. But the other people said, no, look, it's better to save two people's lives, even if it means killing one. Because inaction is killing them. And the doctor, actually, while this ethical debate was going on in the newspapers, and I got really interested to see exactly how it turned out, the doctor just went ahead and aborted one kid. So the mother and the other child could survive. That is not bad karma. It's the best they could do. 3. Also, is it true that if someone has done an abortion, forgiveness, Anguli Mala, he killed thousands of people, could still become an arahat. Forgive, let go. So it's not a huge thing. People do many more bad things. As I said, a husband who goes and sleeps with another woman, not his wife, makes much worse karma than a woman who has an abortion, I say. So, you men should feel very guilty, not just a woman. Anyway, 3. Also, is it true that the consciousness in the fetus could be asked to return again in the subsequent pregnancy before the abortion? Yes, it can and it does. One of my disciples had their first child. Actually, it was their sister. I was thinking the owner of the house where the ghost is outside. It was that family's sister. When the wife was pregnant with the first child, they had an ultrasound just a couple of days before birth. Everything was fine. Then those couple of days, the baby turned in the womb, strangled itself on the umbilical cord, and came out stillborn. So close, but didn't quite make it. And I performed the funeral service for the baby. They called him Charlie, a boy. And as sometimes they do in Thailand, there were Thais. Well, I wasn't looking, while the undertaker wasn't looking, they got out a biro pen and they put a mark, a line, on the heel of Charlie's little baby feet. And then covered the coffin, was cremated. Shortly afterwards, she became pregnant again. This time she took a lot of care, and the pregnancy was successful. She gave birth to a little girl called Anne. This time she took a lot of care, and the pregnancy was successful. She gave birth to a little girl called Anne. But of course, they looked to see if there's anything on the foot, and sure enough, there's the mark. Now, you don't have birthmarks on heels of feet. What actually happened is a common way to see if Charlie's going to come back again. We'll mark him just to see. If he comes back, he'll come back with that mark. And he did. Only he's a girl this time. And that's actually very common. It shows actually, yeah, they are coming back again. Actually, if you want to read more about that, Professor Ian Stevenson wrote a whole book while he's in Magdalen College in Oxford about birthmarks. And that's one of the things which he researched, about making marks on a dead person to see if they come back again. So if you know anyone, or if you have a young child, and they die, you know, either before birth or just shortly afterwards, and you're looking for another kid, put a mark somewhere on their body, just, you know, with a pen. When you get pregnant again and give birth, have a look for that mark. If it's the same being, they will have that mark. Next question. Why do enlightened monks and nuns disrobe? Enlightened monks and nuns would never disrobe. It's only the unenlightened ones, the stupid ones. If you're enlightened, you can't disrobe. You see, even a stream winner, if you're a stream winner as a monk or a nun, it says in the sutras, even if kings come and offer you millions of dollars, you will never take it. Because having seen the Dhamma is worth much, much more. Even the most beautiful girl will not make you disrobe. As a monk, the most handsome man will never make you disrobe. If you've seen the Dhamma, that's it. You're a monk, nun for life. And enlightened monks and nuns never disrobe. So if you see someone disrobe, obviously they didn't quite make it this lifetime. But pull a mark on their robe, they may get reborn again. Become an arahat next time. If I see light but can still feel the body, then is it the sunlight? It's a yellow colour, sometimes almost blinding, but the brightness was not constant. Is it because my mind is playing tricks on me? Should I go back to focusing on the breath or a mantra? It is a nimitta if it's really bright, because sometimes you can still feel the body. It's as if the nimitta and the body consciousness are just competing for your attention. The mind is not that strong that it's too dominant. The five senses and the mind about equal in amplitude, equal in strength. That's why sometimes you see the nimitta, sometimes the body, sometimes you can hear sound. They're just vying for whichever one becomes prominent. If you keep still, eventually the sounds, the feelings in the body will all disappear as the mind becomes so bright it blocks out everything else. So it was a nimitta, just keep on going. Be still, don't move, don't do anything, and it will grow. Yeah, Ajahn, would like to clarify when you said you ordained two German brothers and they were the only sons. Is it that they've got sisters? No, they've got no sisters. That's the only two children, and I got both of them. Who is taking care will take care of their parents. Their parents are still very healthy and well, quite wealthy, living in Germany, having a good time. If the parents do get very old, then the children will look after them for sure. You can still look after your parents as a monk. You know, just like many monks would actually go and care for their parents. So if you are afraid, oh, when I become old, if my son becomes a monk, my daughter becomes a nun, who will look after me? My goodness, you have a whole monastery looking after you. It's much, much better than just having just one or two sons or daughters. Hey Ajahn, so it's neat to ask. When you mentioned about the nature, that nature take its way, would that mean the nature is conditioned by karma? Okay, the nature is conditioned, yes, it's by karma. This is particularly the karma of letting go. That nature has its rules. It's called Dhamma. It's like the laws of physics. That's the Dhamma of nature. There's the Dhamma of the mind, the laws of the mind. And that's what's discovered by the Buddha. Just as Newton discovered the laws of physics by sitting under a tree, so did the Buddha discover the laws of Dhamma sitting under a tree. The Newton was hit by an apple, the Buddha was hit by jhana. And saw the Dhamma. Because of that, he understood the laws of nature, and so let nature take its course. I mean, not you changing nature, but let nature just allow the mind to become very soft and very still, seeing dependent origination, and seeing dependent cessation as well. Let the cessation take its course. To teach the Dhamma, and then let go. If we couldn't achieve nimitta in this retreat, is it because our virtues are not enough? Can you explain more of this? It's not your virtues, it's your wanting. Stop wanting the blooming nimitta. I should have mentioned it in the first place. And then you might then you might have seen it. It's really hard as a teacher. If you don't teach those things, then when they come up, people, oh, this is nothing, and they go away, they leave it alone, they don't know what's going on. If you teach it, they get wanting and desire. It's so difficult. So I decided years ago to teach the nimittas, to teach the jhanas. They happen, they're there, they're part of the path. You can't avoid them. If you go to the path of letting go, you have to come across these jhanas, you have to come across these nimittas. People say, do you have to do these? Of course you have to do these things. And if you go to the toilet, you have to go into that room, first of all, where the wash basins are in. You can't just avoid the wash basins and climb through the window of the toilet and just sit down in there. If you go in an aircraft, you have to go through customs and immigration, first of all. You can't just avoid customs and immigration and go straight into the aircraft. But, you know, people say, do we have to go through jhanas and nimittas? You have to. It's just what happens. It's the path. So because of that, you have to teach these things, but to teach them with a lot of emphasis on how they happen, what the causes are, especially letting go, peace. And then you know the causes. Okay, next question. The Buddhist teaching centers around compassion, compassion for all beings. Also, one of the eight precepts is to abstain from killing. What is your opinion and advice on the killing of house pests? Little cockroaches, rodents, dengue mosquitoes. If we let them go around, they might spread harmful diseases, illnesses to humans and other animals, isn't it? Thank you, with metta. With metta to me, but not to the cockroaches. You have to be very careful with pest exterminating. Because what happens is you start with mosquitoes because they may have dengue fever. And then you start with the cockroaches because you think they may have diseases. And then you carry on and extinguish or rather destroy the pest. You exterminate the pest, which is your husband. He's a pest. And then you go on to your other enemies. You end up being the great pest exterminator. You exterminate people of not of your own religion. You're not of your own race, you're enemies. You're the great pest exterminator, like, you know, armies of pest exterminators. Let's exterminate the pests in Iraq. Let's exterminate the pests in Afghanistan. Let's exterminate the pests in... Get out of that pest exterminating business. It's not just rodents. That's what it starts with. Ends up with your husband and anyone you hate. So you can't exterminate everybody. You have to learn how to live with these things. You can't exterminate sort of the things you don't like in your wife or your kids. You have to tolerate them. You can't change and convert everybody to being a Buddhist or a Catholic or an Anglican or anything. People are going to have their differences. We have to tolerate each other and learn to be at peace with things. So the Buddha said, yeah, extermination is great, but exterminate the right things, not the cockroaches. Exterminate your greed, hate and delusion. That's the pest in your house. And if you exterminate greed, hate and delusion, your cockroaches will become your friends. The mosquitoes will never give you dengue fever. People get those fevers because their immune system is so weak. Many people can be bitten by malaria or mosquito or dengue carrying mosquito. Only some people get the fever and the illness. It's not the dengue fevers. It's not the malaria person's fault. It's because people have got too much stress. They don't come to meditation retreats or they don't do what they're told in the retreat. So kill the pests of the Buddha's pest exterminating business called meditation. We exterminate all your household pets of greed, hate and delusion, fear and anger. One spray of jhana, or maybe a repeated spray of jhana does the job. Okay, so that's what you should do. If you have all these things, look after your house, keep it clean, wash all the surfaces, make sure there's no food left around, and then, you know, you don't really have that problem. Make sure there's mosquito screens on the doors and the windows, and then the mosquitoes don't come in. Also, maybe have your view on gambling more for leisure without much money involved. Aha, gambling. How many of you... Oh, you all heard a story about the five angels. I think I told that the first time. Haven't you? Five angels? Gambling? Haven't heard that story? Okay. This is a story I always tell about the dangers of gambling. Also, the dangers of prophecy. Because many years ago in Perth, a man had a dream. You know that one, yeah? He dreamt of five angels. Did I say that here? He dreamt of five angels. Each angel had five big pots of gold. They lined up and gave him 25 pots of gold. Worth a fortune. It's one of those dreams when you're so happy. And then as soon as he received his last pot of gold, he woke up. He was in his bedroom. There were no angels in his bedroom, but even worse, no pots of gold. Of the two, he'd have settled for the gold rather than the devas. But he realized it was only a dream. So he went down for his breakfast. And he was very surprised. That morning, his wife had made him five boiled eggs and five pieces of toast. What's with this number five, he started to think. When he looked at his morning newspaper, he got prickles up and down his spine. It was the 5th of May, the 5th day of the 5th month. This dream was so strong, it must be an omen. So he looked in the back of the newspaper, in the sports pages, in the horse racing. He noticed in one of the horse racing courses in Perth, it was called Ascot. It's named after the British race course of the same name, but we've got one in Perth as well. He quickly worked out Ascot, five letters. So he looked straight away in race number five. If number five was his lucky number, he might find something there. But he couldn't believe his eyes. In race number five, horse number five, guess what it was called? Five Angels. Five Angels was running that afternoon. In race number five, at Ascot, A-S-C-O-T, on the 5th of May. And he just dreamt of five angels offering him five pots of gold each. He had five boiled eggs and five pieces of toast. It was just, the coincidence was just too strong. It couldn't be a mistake. So he took the afternoon off work. Before going to the racetrack, he went to the bank. To keep the lucky number five, he drew $5,000 out of his bank. He went to the racetrack again to keep the lucky number five. He chose the 5th bookmaker in line. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's the one. Five was his lucky number today. He put $5,000 to win on five angels. Horse number five, race number five. The omen just couldn't be wrong. It was just too many coincidences. The lucky number five couldn't be wrong. It wasn't wrong. The horse came in 5th. Serves him right. That's what happens with gambling. You can never know, even omens. But if it's gambling, if it really is just for this bit of fun, because I remember as a kid, we used to play cards with my father. It was for like pennies, only small amounts of money, and my father would always manage to lose. Instead of actually giving us pocket money, he played cards with us as a way of spending time with his children, having fun with them, a bit of No, father, children bonding. And he'd deliberately lose. We knew that, but we never tell him. And it was just for fun. If it really is for fun, you don't take it too seriously, and you know, you really are relaxed about it, fine. No big thing. But be careful, because sometimes for some people gambling is a disease. They are concerned about it. And they don't just, you know, play for pennies or cents just for fun. They play for the real thing. And unfortunately, I know many terrible stories. There is a casino in Perth. I know some people who worked in that casino, and they tell me what happens there, and it's disgusting. Some people, they go there, they start gambling. Usually, I don't know what it is, they usually win the first time. And they think it's easy money, they keep on gambling. And there comes a time when they start losing. When they lose, they always gamble more to try and get their losses back again. They just go deeper into debt. And they stay at that casino. There is some well-known gangsters. The police for years have been trying to nail them with something. They're just too clever. But they're hanging around that casino. When they see someone losing heavily, they'll give them a loan. $10,000, $20,000. They take this big wad of cash out of their pocket and give it to them. They know what's going to happen next. They will lose more. They won't be able to pay it back. So many of these women, they give them a choice. You'll break your legs or you come and work for us as a prostitute. Sex slavery. You see, these poor women, they go there and they've got no choice. Selling their bodies to pay off their gambling debts. And they never manage to pay those debts off. Everyone knows what's going on, the just police can't touch them. They're just too smart, too wealthy. It's a hell realm. And it's just so hard to get people out of that hell once they get in it. So that's why the Buddha called gambling, he called it like the mouth or the entrance to danger. Abhayamukha. The entrance to very fearful and fearsome states. So be very, very, very careful. If you go gambling big time, you're lost. All gamblers are losers, eventually. Ajahn Brahm, it's exciting to see devas appearing on photos on these nights. Could you share with us what should be the correct attitude with regard to these photos in our practice? You can actually take copies of those photos, show them to your friends, but use them as inspirations for yourself. To know that you've been on a retreat and devas appeared, and that gives inspiration to you. You can show it to your Christian friends. Because what it does, it shows them that, you know, it's not just in Christianity you get miracles. Whenever there's good people, there are miracles. In other words, that, you know, this is proof that goodness, kindness, loving kindness, meditation is a very good thing. And the reason why I say that is because I used to be a scientist, a physicist, and there's just too many people out there that are skeptical. It's not as if they don't believe or they've got an open mind. They believe that such things cannot happen. If you show them that photograph, they say, okay, I know, you all digitally enhanced it. You took it to the laboratory and you sort of messed around with it. But you can show it and say it was done straight away. But it's good to actually show people. It gives them faith, inspiration, which is good. Dear Ajahn Brahm, my friend's mother suffers from urinary tract infection. Since then, she cannot move at all and is bedridden. She is 78 years old, fully conscious. And if saying, how are you feeling today, is not appropriate, neither you have my permission to die is applicable because she still looks good for her age. I want to talk to her and to comfort her, but I do not know what to say. Please help me how to be wise to comfort her. You can just tell them what you've been doing today. Say you went to a retreat and you saw devas on a photograph. So talk about devas. Talk about life. Talk about whatever she's interested in. Talk about the family. Talk about all those things you would talk to her about if she wasn't sick. When she wasn't sick, did you have anything to talk to her about? Or were you bored and didn't know what to say? So the important thing is, you talk to her as your mother, as you would talk to her if you didn't have that urinary tract infection. That's what she wants to hear. Have you ever been sick in hospital? And people keep on focusing on the disease or the sickness again and again. You want to hear what the family's doing. Just like if you had a cup of coffee with your best friend, just talk about things, just chat about ordinary things. There was a Tibetan nun who was dying of cancer. Just talk about things, just chat about ordinary things. There was a Tibetan nun who was dying of cancer. Because there wasn't that too many monks and nuns in Perth at the time, sort of I was her friend. Just before she was about to die, she gave me a call. Can you come to the hospice? She said, I think I've only got a couple of days to go. She was actually wrong. I think she only had one day to go. So I stopped what I was doing. I got in the monastery vehicle and got driven to the hospice, which was about an hour and a quarter, an hour and a half away. When I got into the hospice, I had to check in first of all, and there's this really awful authoritarian nurse at the counter. When I say I've come to here to see so-and-so, she said, I'm very sorry. She's given explicit instructions. She doesn't want any visitors at all. And I said, oh, listen, look, she just rang me up an hour and a half ago. I've come all the way. No, you cannot go in. We have to respect our patient's wishes. She barked at me. But I, even if you think I'm a soft monk, I will not be intimidated. I said, listen, 1.5 hours ago, she invited me personally. We can't disrespect her wishes, can we? And so she really glared at me and said, come here. So I followed her and we went to the door of her room, and there was a big sign there. Absolutely, she'd written, no visitors. And the nurse said, see? So I had a look and I saw on the bottom, like the fine print in any sales, any invoice, had another word underneath, two words or three words. Absolutely no visitors. Except Ajahn Brahm. She'd written that underneath. So with great glee, I know it was a bit mean, I told that nurse, see? I shouldn't have done that, but I did enjoy it. And so I went in. And when I asked that lady, why was it that you said no visitors except for me? She told me that every visitor who'd come to see her, seeing her, you know, when a person is dying of cancer, they get so thin, you know, all their sort of muscles waste away, they look like a corpse. And she had one of those diseases. As soon as they see me, they start crying, they get so depressed, they go so upset. I said, it's hard enough dealing with my own death. Dealing with other people's, you know, emotions is just too much for me. So I don't want to, I know I'm dying. I don't need sort of people crying when they come and see me. I want someone to come and talk to me as a friend. I want someone who comes and tells me jokes. Ajahn Brahm, what's your latest joke? So I spent the next hour just talking to her as if I talked to her when she had no sickness at all. I talked to her as a person. Said a few jokes, a bit of dumb as well. But not, I didn't talk to her illness, and that's why she invited me in. I can understand that. If you're dying, you know you're dying. If you're sick, you know you're sick. Don't you sometimes want a bit of relief to be treated as a person? So go and talk about the latest gossip, what's going on in the world, who's done what to who and when and how. Just like the person would want to hear if she wasn't sick. Anyway, I developed rashes all over my face. Has it anything to do with meditation? No. I think it must be. It's always some too much tension. That's why you get rashes. So just really be still, really be peaceful. All your rashes will go away. You get derashed. If there is no self, who is the owner of his or her karma? It's your stream of consciousness is the owner of your karma. It's your stream of consciousness gets pain, so be caring to your stream of consciousness. That is the owner of karma. The stories in your book are very inspiring and interesting. Would you consider to translate the book into other language, such as Mandarin, to benefit more? Thank you. May you be well and happy. Sometimes the jokes just don't go in translation. You know, you tried that before, and sometimes, you know, you tell this amazing funny joke, you translate it into Thai, and people look at you as if you're stupid. Because sometimes that humour is actually culturally specific. So some of those jokes work if you're English educated, but you try and translate them, they just don't work at all. So that's why it's difficult to translate these things, although that a few people, it has been translated into German, and it's being translated into Indonesian. I don't know if that would work or not, but someone's trying it. So once it's translated, I'll see what people say. And if it works, then you know, we'll print it. But if not, just English. Most people can speak English these days. If they can't speak English, at least they can read English. Because then they have to use the internet. So you know what it's like in a language. It's much harder to speak it than it is to read it or to understand it when it's spoken. But especially reading it. So most people can read it. So I wonder really if it's really necessary to translate it. However, if you really want to give it a try, you can do it. But you've got to, I think someone already mentioned they wanted to try to translate it into Mandarin. So I told them, go and contact the publisher, because actually it's their business. And they have to give permission. Dear Ajahn Brahm, does each one of us perceive and make the world and karma linked up or... Dear Ajahn Brahm, does each one of us perceive and make the world and karma linked up all of us in the world, each of us perceive? I've got to read that again somehow. This is what sometimes if it's in a strange language it doesn't come across. Maybe it's upside down. No. I think I understand the question. Each one of us perceive and make the world and karma links us all up in the world each of us has perceived. In the sense that we contribute to the way we perceive the world. It's like when I was a child, people used to give me these colouring books. There were black lines on white paper with some numbers in. They say, colour this number yellow, this number red, or whatever. And I coloured those numbers in, and out of that white sheet of paper and black lines came a house or an elephant. It's the children's picture books. And I use that as a simile for life. Life is like a series of black lines on white paper. There is some sort of limit to what we can make of this world, but how we colour it in is up to us. So it's our perception colours in the world. We can't just make anything we want of it because it's some limitations, the black lines on the white paper, but we make 90% of this world. And you can colour this world in bright, brilliant, beautiful colours, or you can colour it all black and grey and grungy brown. It's up to you how you colour this world. So if you've got cancer, you can colour it beautiful colours, wonderful. Well, great opportunity to understand Dhamma. Or you can have a nice meditation retreat and colour it all black and dull. Yeah. What you experience, you colour it. So if you've got a partner in life, you can colour them, my ugly wife. My selfish husband. Or you can colour them, in other words, to see all the wonderful qualities. Oh, my beautiful husband. He needs a lot of work, but he's got Buddha nature inside, I can see that. Oh, my delightful wife. She may not be the most beautiful girl in the world, but she's got such a wonderful character. Colour your world. Make it bright. May you explain the process of death and rebirth. Yes, first you die, then you get reborn. Come on, I've got to go quickly through these questions. I've mentioned that many times already. Craving drives you. Karma gives you the means. With those two together, if you've got the means, you've got the desire, that's where you get reborn. That keeps propelling your stream of consciousness, even now and in the future as well. Craving, desire, doing, and the means to achieve that, your good karma or bad karma. Those two together combine to drive the life force from moment to moment, life to life. I read from a Dharma book that one meditator starts seeing ghosts streaming into the streets at 5 p.m. onwards. Is this true? Yeah, they knock off work at 5 p.m. and go home. That's why you have traffic jams of ghosts at 5 p.m. The police ghosts have to come around at 5 p.m. to direct traffic. No. Our ghosts are around all the time. We all know this. Ghosts only come out at night. Isn't that so? Do you see ghosts during the day? Or do they come out at night? Anytime, yes. So why are you afraid of the dark? You should be afraid of the light as well. Ghosts are just as likely to come out now. But we think that ghosts only come out at night time. So that's why we get afraid. It's just our stupid perception. So the point is that ghosts at any time. So a meditator sees ghosts streaming into the streets at 5 a.m. onwards. Of course, it's silly. Now those ghosts are there any old time. That's just the perception, not real. Ghosts are around all the time, yes. How do we coexist with ghosts? Do we literally walk into them without knowing and vice versa? Sometimes yes. Sometimes you just see them. You don't realize they're ghosts. They look just the same as you. One of the favorite ghost stories. I heard this years ago. Other monks use this story. Ajahn Sujata used this story at the conference in June. The ghost in Sirirat Hospital. There's heaps of ghosts in hospitals. You probably walk past them many times and haven't noticed. The point is, in the Thai hospitals, when a person dies, you've seen them wear white strings. When a ghost dies, they put a red string on. You got a red string? That's only in Thailand. If you went to Thailand, take that red string off, put a white one on. Otherwise, you freak people out. But I missed story. Because that's an old tradition, in the hospital when somebody dies, they put a red string around their wrist before they take them to the mortuary. Early one morning, the doctor who had been on night shift was in the elevator going down to the ground floor to get into his car and go home. In the lift, he had a nurse in the lift with him, a witness. The elevator stopped at third or fourth floor. It was somebody wanted to come in. It was a patient. When the doors opened, they saw this patient who was trying to get into the lift. The doctor froze in fear, and as quick as he could, pushed the close the door button before the man could get in. And the nurse said, "What do you do that for?" And the doctor said, "That was one of my patients. He died last night. You've just seen a ghost trying to get into this elevator. He's just on the other side of the doors now." That's scary. A ghost just between you and the elevator doors. And the nurse said, "Are you sure?" He said, "Yeah, I'm sure. Didn't you see the red string on his wrist?" And the nurse thought, "Oh, I've got a red string too. Does that mean I'm not allowed in the elevator?" And that was a story told by the doctor when they found him unconscious on the floor of the lift. He fainted. When he came to, they asked him what had happened. That was the story he told. The last he remembered was a nurse asking, showing the red string, "Am I allowed in the lift as well?" He had a ghost inside and one outside. And when they checked afterwards, he described the nurse, yet she'd actually died on the way to work that morning in a road accident. And she'd come in to work as a ghost. You know, we're going to go over time, who cares? This is one of the most amazing ghost stories I've heard. Now this is really strange, but it was well documented. It happened in Australia some years ago. Fascinating story. It was a marriage. You know, it's usually the custom in a marriage that the bride gets us to the church a few minutes late. It may be it's 3 o'clock, but actually the bride deliberately tries to get there at 3:05. Not too early, not too late, but certainly not on time. It's tradition. So the bride got there 5 minutes late, and when she went in, the groom hadn't appeared yet. So of course she was very concerned because it was planned the groom should be waiting there, you know, waiting for the bride. So she went into the church and was waiting. You know, maybe he was late. When it got to about 20 past the hour, she really started getting concerned. You know, maybe she'd been stood up, or maybe there was an accident or something. She was very, very, this is her wedding day. And as she was getting very concerned, she was very relieved to see her groom rush into the church. He was late, because indeed there had been an accident, a car accident. And you could see his best suit, wedding suit, was all crumpled. He had a few scratches and bruises on him. He actually looked really the worse for wear. And of course she was relieved to see him alive. And she was relieved actually that the wedding could go ahead. But she looked at him and said, look, let's take you to hospital first of all. You know, you look really bad. He said, no, no, I'm okay. No, come to hospital. No, this is our wedding. I feel okay, believe me. Let's get married. And so, it was a wedding day, so she believed her groom. So they went through the wedding ceremony. And the wedding ceremony went perfect, just according to plan. They did all the vows, exchange rings and everything. And then they went outside and had the confetti thrown over them, the photographs. And then they went in their car to drive to the reception, for the party. And they went in, I think, the bride's car. The bride actually was driving it. And the groom was sitting next to her. And as they went to the reception, they passed just a little hill in front of everybody else. And when the other part of the entourage followed behind, they found that the bride and groom's car had stopped. And the bride was just sobbing uncontrollably. She was hysterical. And there was no sign of the groom. She said, what's happened? Has he run away? What happened? And when the bride could speak, she said, as they were just going over that hill, the passenger, her new husband, had just vanished into space and disappeared. And she didn't understand what was going on. On her wedding day, her husband had completely disappeared, vanished into thin air. When they made inquiries afterwards, they found early that afternoon, about 2 hours previously, there had been an accident at that very spot. The person killed in that accident was her husband. The groom had died on the way to the wedding, had wanted to get married so much, the ghost had gone to that church. It was a woman who married a ghost. Isn't that weird? It was true. It's in one sense, it's quite sweet and romantic. The love of that man for his wife-to-be was so strong. The craving, if you like, the desire was so strong. He managed to get that mind-made body looking so real and go through the ceremony. So at least his wife would be married to him, even though she married him after he died. Isn't that nice? Was that scary? What do you think? Anyway, everyone's interested, we'll talk about ghost stories. Okay, all ghosts, hungry ghosts. Okay, I have to say sorry, apologize, it's 20 to 10. And all these other questions, I'm sorry, but you haven't got merit. Your karma is not strong enough for me to answer these questions. So, it's also because you asked too many questions, obviously. But please forgive me, it means you have to come to the next retreat the next time to get these questions answered. So that's the end of all questions. So I hope you enjoyed that. And that's the questions done for now. Okay, now there are some interviews, but because this is the last time for interviews, and there'll probably be many people, literally 5 minutes each. And I'm going to, this time Mangala, who's going to be sitting next to me, is going to be with the clock. After 5 minutes, he's going to ring the bell. Hit a bell with a gong. If you're still there with 6 minutes, you become the gong. And it hits you. Strictly 5 minutes, 6 minutes. You better get out quick, otherwise he'll chase you with a stick. And we've got to finish by, the last interview will be 4:15. Had to finish by 20 past. Because for lunchtime. Okay, so if you want to get an interview, you have to get in there quickly. Literally 5 minutes. So get what you want to say quickly in your head. No need to bow. Get in that chair quickly. Sit. Ask your question. Okay, good.